Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, autocratic regimes often use people throughout the population to be informants. Why do people choose to become an informant and collaborate with autocracies? And what constitutes justice against these informants once the state democratizes? Doug Becker explores in a new book.
I'm Doug Becker. Under authoritarian regimes, individuals are often faced with the decision whether to cooperate with the government or face reprisals. And these regimes rely on individuals to inform on their neighbors, their co-workers, even their friends. Why do people choose to become informers? What happens to these informers when the government democratizes? How can a society ensure justice following such this authoritarian period, seeking to move to a more transparent, democratic, free nation? Our guests today have written a new book on the issue, the role of informants and their experiences both during the autocratic government and the justice mechanisms following the autocracy. Their specific case is Czechoslovakia and its democratization following its communist regime starting in the late 1980s. The book is called Informers Up Close, and its authors are Mark Drumble and Barbora Hola. Mark Drumble is professor at Washington Lee University School of Law and director of the university's Transnational Law Institute. He's the author of Atrocity, Punishment, and International Law, Reimagining Child Soldiers in International Law and Policy, and the co-editor of Sights, Sounds, and Sensibilities of Atrocity Prosecution with Caroline Fournet. And Barbora Hola works as a senior researcher at the NSCR and is professor at the Department of Criminal Law and Criminology at BU Amsterdam. She is co-editor of Punishment in International Society, Norms, Justice, and Punitive Practices, and the co-author of There's Something Special About War Criminals. Thank you both very, very much for joining us on this incredibly important issue. And Barbora, I'm going to start with you. The book delves into questions about informants, why people become informants, what might be that motivation, what exactly is an informant. So what do you mean by informants, and what would motivate somebody to inform?
Well, thank you, Doug, for having us. It's really great to be here. And informers, who are informers? So in our case, informers are people or individuals who cooperated with the secret police back in communist Czechoslovakia. So these are the people who actually were oftentimes approached by secret police officers and asked to convey information, and the information could have related to opposition. It could have related also to their friends, colleagues, to their workplaces, basically anything and everything. And these are just ordinary people, basically people like you and me, who just were living normal lives. And at a certain point of time, perhaps secret police approached them and asked them to collaborate.
And how much was the motivation fear? So when I think about informants, I guess one of the key questions is, are you working as an informant because you're afraid of the state? Or are you trying to gain something as a result of it? You know, good favor, maybe money or something?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And I think that it can be a bit of both in the same person. So in the book, we actually look at motivations or emotions which motivate informing, and we distinguish four. It's a fear, devotion, resentment, and ambition. And what you see oftentimes is actually that the same person have many motivations, which change across time. It can change depending on the issue. But generally, actually, the discourse in Czech Republic is that many informers were actually afraid of secret police as well, and were either afraid or were very, very devoted to the ideology. And this sort of like a black and white picture is not entirely true, because people were motivated by different things, and they could start with a fear, and then actually over a period of time, the fear went away and changed into something else, which can be exactly as you said, wanting something, wanting to study at a university, wanting to keep a good job, wanting a better job, wanting to travel abroad. It was also to an extent barter or exchange as well. So information for some favors. And that sort of worked quite well back in the time as well.
And Mark Trumbull, the book highlights something that I think we all kind of had known that these communist regimes, autocratic regimes, maybe broadly, but definitely these communist regimes, really were pretty reliant on these informers. It really, that's the way the government was able, to dominate the country. Could you talk a bit about the importance of this and what this says about the nature of the government, of the
Yeah,
government?
sure. Absolutely, Doug. So I think that's an important point. Now, as Barbora pointed out, our case study is communist Czechoslovakia. We didn't choose Czechoslovakia because it was particularly heinous or particularly graceful in the communist years. We chose it because Barbora is actually a Czech national. I don't speak any Czech. So it was the only way to actually delve into the secret police files. So there's nothing particularly singular about Czechoslovakia other than the idiosyncrasy that is a case study we could genuinely and thoroughly explore. However, like other countries in Central and Eastern Europe in the communist regime, life at that time was a push and pull between two major forces. The first is one that you identified, namely the dominance of the state. And here we use the terminology of the state as the engineer of the souls. In other words, souls as in not on your feet, but in your chest, right? And this idea that through autocracy, through education, limiting opportunities, creating opportunities, the state had a heavy hand in how people live their daily lives. But there's another force, and that is what we identify as participatory dictatorship. In other words, citizens also had some agency, autonomy, space for discretion. And they utilized those spaces in order to make the most and socially navigate within an overall society of repression. And that exactly leads us to the informer, because the state needed the informer for the purposes of ensuring some control over national security. And ensuring the fear and instilling the fear that their diktats would be followed. On the other hand, informing also provided something for ordinary citizens. It was a space, a place, a line, a chime through which ordinary citizens were able to maneuver, express resentment, settle scores, as Barbora said, get ahead, get things. And I think it's crucially important to recognize that life in the autocracy of communist Czechoslovakia was lived both through participation and repression, and informing as an act of social navigation in many ways was central to living in that system. And that's why, and I'll end on this, that's why we wanted to dig deep and identify the very human condition, the human emotions behind why people ratted each other out and refused to do so as well.
Now, Mark, the political scientist in me immediately thinks of this as this notion of the importance of informants means that the state is constantly present in a person's life. That ultimately, this nature of governance means no matter what decision you make, you always have to think about the state. So, is the process of the informants, obviously the information they get is important, but was it the information that was most important, or was it just the state is always there?
Actually, as Barbora alluded to earlier, the overwhelming majority of the information that we were able to assess in the files that actually was provided from informer to secret police officer, the overwhelming majority of that was scurrilous, irrelevant gossip, tales of love affairs, alcoholism, taking some money in petty cash in the office, not doing your job properly, being too loud as a neighbor. All of these kinds of things that are at best marginally related to national security. But you're right. The mere presence of these networks and the reality that anyone could be informed upon at any time actually led to the state being able to exercise its power as a cudgel and actually break into and divide personal relationships by allowing state authority to enter into the most intimate of spaces. But there's one thing I do want to say, and that is part of our book is not only to look at informing as something that happens far away in autocratic societies, ones that have been left to the dustbin of history or ones that exist now or may appear in the future. Informing is also central to liberal democracy. And in our last chapter, or perhaps we can cycle back to this later, we discuss the centrality of informing in the United States, in the United Kingdom. And the fact remains, Doug, no state, no movement, no activism, no matter how virtuous and elegant or how baleful and ugly, nothing can exist without the informer.
And with that, Barbara, I guess one of the questions certainly on my mind then is you're using this term informant, but is there a differentiation between an informant or just a spy, you know, people spying on one another, and just broadly about collaboration, you know, collaborating with a regime? Are there distinctions with those words?
Yes, I think there are. So collaborators is, I would say, like umbrella term for the phenomenon which informers fall into as well. And informers are a subset of collaborators. Collaborators are those who, oftentimes the term is used, for example, in wars, right? In conflicts, when people collaborate with enemies. So then you have different types of collaborators, and collaboration and informing is one of them. I think what distinguishes informers from collaborators is that informing is oftentimes done in secret. It is repeated. It is done in secrecy. So informing to secret police, for example. And informing, the term has it in itself, is about information. So delivering information to authorities. Collaboration can consist of anything and everything, right? So if you, for example, look nowadays in Ukraine, oftentimes like a daily activities, like working in a trash company are in occupied territories are considered to be collaboration. So collaboration is much, much broader term than informing. And when it comes to spies, I think that spies are like James Bond-like, right? So these government officials who are trained and spy on other powers. That basically is very, very sort of like a layman definitions, I think, how I would distinguish collaborators, informers, and spies.
And also, Babar, I mean, when I think of the communist regimes in particular, there were stories about like public denunciations, you know, people coming out and publicly denouncing, you know, an adversary, neighbor, you know, whatever. That's different than when you talk about the informants, correct?
Absolutely. And if you think about communist regimes, actually, an act of informing was not limited to informers. I don't know whether it makes sense, but sort of during these regimes, there was exactly, as you say, Doug, a culture of denunciation. So the citizens were actually encouraged and incited to inform on others, to teachers, pupils, to teachers, police as we do in democracies, but it was sort of much more widespread than only informing to secret police. So informers, as we construct them in the book, are also subset of people who informed on others to authorities, either publicly or secretly.
Absolutely. And listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the role of informants and their importance in autocratic and perhaps also non-autocratic societies on the basis of a new book called Informers Up Close with its authors, Mark Drumble, who's a professor at Washington Lee University School of Law, and Barbara Hoar, who's a professor in the Department of Criminology, of Criminal Law and Criminology at VU Amsterdam. So I want to give a little bit of space here when talking about these informers, and in particular, the motivations of the informers. And I'll turn to you first, Mark. You have a lot of narratives. You actually have, you know, some specific case studies. Is there anything particularly striking about what would motivate somebody to choose to be an informer, you know, on the basis of some of the stories that you're telling?
Yeah, so initially, in terms of our method, we went through well over 100 files in the secret police files in Prague. And through a process in which we attempted to portray an inclusive array of individuals, both in terms of gender, in terms of the period of time in which they were informers, the kind of job or occupation they had, whether they were party members or not, we distilled out 17 principal characters, and we presented them in what we call a file story, namely biographically shared their life cycle as an informer, including all the information that they shared. We did anonymize, just as a matter of ethics. Then we pulled out six that we featured in the book, and those six were included in chapter four in narrative form, and the remainder are found in an online appendix to the book. As Barbora said earlier, informers come from all walks of life. We had sex workers, students, senior Communist Party members, artists, academics, manual laborers, and a lot of them presented through very different motivations. Resentment was a big one. A lot of people leveraged, as I said earlier, the informer role to get even with others. A lot took the informer role as a place to ventilate and share, almost in a social work capacity, with their STB officer. And they often became friends with their STB officer. And there's many reports in there of STB officers giving the informer's family member a birthday cake or dropping by. We've had a report in one, a case of an informer when his role as an informer was terminated, was heartbroken and beseeched the secret police to be able to continue to speak with him. And he even wrote a very powerful poem called Sigh, which we reproduce in the book, that just expressed his melancholy about the termination. Many others initially were roped in by fear. And common devices for fear were a person made an administrative gaffe, made a small petty crime, was reported to be having an affair, was reported to having been drinking too much. And then the secret police ensnared them with that. And then, almost in a deal, a barter arrangement, like Barbora said earlier, would make things go away in exchange for this kind of cooperation. But what we found overall is that there was an incredible diversity of stories in terms of their experiences, but some commonalities. And just to riff back to the difference between the spy and the informer, our informers are such ordinary, marginalized, flotsam and jetsam of Czech society at the time. They're individuals for whom there are very limited social opportunities in many instances. They are not exotic spies. They're not brazen or bullish or boisterous. There's no James Bonding going on, although some saw themselves as James Bond characters. They certainly weren't. And they were really caught up in the cogs of this machine. And then they made that machine work for them a little bit.
And by the way, we're going to circle back to this a bit. But what you were describing, somebody commits an infraction, you know, crime, they get in trouble with the law, and they decide to become an informant. That sounds awfully familiar in the United States. In fact, a lot of the cases are built by, let's get somebody who's committed the small crime, and then we will pardon you, or, you know, not prosecute the small crime in order to get somebody bigger. So I imagine that process is actually fairly similar.
Yeah. So, and also what we notice is that a number of informers have agency. They often terminate the informing relationship. They get bored and bow out. They refuse to give information on certain kinds of people. They play a cat and mouse game. They dissemble, they delay. The files reveal all of this. And to me, those are very important elements. And I think when we think about the informing process, we also stylize it as conversation and intimacy and social navigation. Some of these relationships lasted for 40 years.
And that I indeed think that there is a similarity between like a criminal informants in the US and these people, especially when it comes to motivations. I think that oftentimes the motivations are not so different.
Very interesting. Now Barbara, what Mark was describing then is a lot of the informants seem to come from marginalized areas of society. And I think when you add to that number of scholars talking about under autocracy, what really breaks down is horizontal connections. You're not able to join groups and talk about what's going on in the world. But you have this intense need for some form of a connection. And I imagine the informant is a bit what we might call a vertical connection. So you're able to speak, but speak to the government. So I guess how much of motivation is just this need to try to connect because autocracy atomizes individuals?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And I think that this verticality of relationship over time, oftentimes, turns into horizontal relationship as well, right? And we see exactly as Mark was saying, is that in some of these cases, actually the informer became friends with the STB officer, and they were drinking together, and they were giving each other presents for their birthdays. So in that sense, indeed, like the relationship changes. And I think what is very important to hear, Doug, as well, is the secrecy of the relationship. And I think that the fact that these relationships are secret and all the conversation is meant to be between these two people and never come out, that also, I think, to an extent, changes the rhythm and also what is being said. And especially if it is a long-term relationship, which is secret, then that also has some kind of a influence, impact, I think. So indeed, to an extent, one can say that the informer officer relationship could perhaps to an extent substitute the impossibility to talk normally to other people in public.
But if I can just jump in on that, it's also important to emphasize we're going in one direction, and that's sort of portraying and forming in this social navigation role, and sort of tinged with an element of pathos, and that it's a bit benign. I think we should also be very clear. A lot of people were hurt by what informers did, and a lot of informers themselves also were brutally hurt by the state. One of our informers, Lily, for example, who informed in the 1950s, this was the heightened period of Stalinist repression in Czechoslovakia. Lily was an employee at the Belgian embassy in Prague, and she had a tremendous fancy for what she saw as the cosmopolitan life of the West. And she was an informer, and at the same time, she was also accused of informing against Czechoslovakia for Belgium. And in the to and fro of her file, what we see is tremendous abuse, interrogation, pain. Lily is being sentenced long-term to prison. We see Lily as a very defiant informer who refuses to cooperate and participate and really pays the price. And I think one theme that I do want to throw out there is that the nature of informing changed over the decades of communist rule in Czechoslovakia. The state is not a timeless monolith. In the 50s was a period of heavy oppression that abated in the 60s. The Prague Spring of 1968 was this sort of, épanouissement of this sort of, outburst of joy. Then Operation Danube comes in and crushes the Prague Spring. A period of normalization ensues afterwards, where state repression resumes and then fades out in the 70s and 80s. But informing is a constant through all of these years. But in the 50s, there was a lot of cruelty, a lot of cruelty.
And Mark, to follow this up, I would imagine that if the informants are creating relationships with a state, I mean, at one level, the state's manipulating this need for connection in order to engage to repress. But also that the more connected the informant became, to the state, would have profound implications for them, their own risk. And especially, I mean, if they're informing on their friends, they're informing on coworkers, they're informing on neighbors, the constant risk that they're going to be discovered by their neighbors, by their friends, and be rebuked, be challenged, be attacked, possibly even physically attacked. So the question then is, how much the state seems to be manipulating a human need, at this point.
It is true that among the greatest fears of all informers across the board is this idea of deconspiration, the idea that the informing relationship would be revealed. And that fear was shared both by the secret police officer and the informer. And there are numerous instances where cover gets blown, often by the informer, who many of the informers, especially through time, we found developed substance abuse problems, They didn't cope so well with the world, and sometimes they blew their own cover. But I do want to quickly, before letting Barbora jump in, I want to quickly just add one tweak, I think, to what you said. I'm not convinced that the relationship was per se between the informer and the state. I think the relationship was more between the informer and the individual secret police officer, because we found lots of cases in the files where informers would cease and desist to inform when their secret police officer was replaced with another with whom they didn't have the same kind of bond. And these individual idiosyncrasies, the relationship individuated, actually seems to have made a big difference. And one last quick thing. One of the reasons why secrecy, as Barbora said, was so important was because it maintained it. But then following the fall of communism, all secrets were blown open in public when all the files were open to everyone.
And so then, Barbora, what this raises the question then with respect to motivation is, I guess there's an assumption that if somebody is informing, they're probably a communist. The reason why they're informing is that they support the state. Is that a false assumption?
Well, based on what we saw, I would say so. That's exactly what happened after the fall of communism, actually, in the successor state, the Czech Republic. The prevalent sort of assumption was that the informers were devoted to the regime, that they were like a devoted communists, and therefore, indeed, they cooperated. Which, as Marx said, and I also touched upon, is... far away from reality, very, very far away from reality, I think, because we didn't find so many informers which were ideologically motivated. And interestingly, one which was sort of the, I would say, a biggest ideologue was environmentalist. So it was a person who actually was not so much about communism, but was about protection of the environment. And I think that this one was... the one individual who was very much driven by an ideology or devotion to a cause, and it wasn't communism. So I would indeed say that the assumption that all the informers are ideologues is not a correct one.
When we come back, how should a post-autocratic state confront the actions of informants once the government fails? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. When a state transitions from autocracy to democracy, what exactly should justice be? And how do the institutions both promote and potentially undermine justice? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the process of informants, why they play such an important role in autocratic regimes, and what happens to these informants when the autocratic regime falls. And there's a demand for transparency, for democratization, but maybe perhaps most importantly, for justice when it's uncovered that somebody has been an informant. Our guests today have written a new book on a specific case study. This was a case study in Czechoslovakia, a communist regime until the late 1980s that then will democratize and face these challenges. The book is called Informers Up Close, and our guests are Mark Drumbel. He's professor at Washington Lee University School of Law and the director of the university's Transnational Law Institute. And Barbora Hola, who is a senior researcher at the NSCR and professor in the Department of Criminal Law and Criminology at VU Amsterdam. Thank you again very much for sharing your insights with this book. And Mark, since I know that transnational and transitional justice are issues that you've written about extensively, we'll kind of start there. When the government falls, the so-called Velvet Revolution that will lead to a democratization following, you know, the fall of the communist government, this has to be kind of at the top of the agenda. What do you do with all of these people who had collaborated with the communist regime, who had informed? And my understanding is it was a pretty large number in society. So the idea that you would throw everybody in jail was always a huge challenge. So what was proposed to deal with informants?
So following the Velvet Revolution in November 1989 and the subsequent dissolution of Czechoslovakia into two independent states, we focus on activities in the Czech Republic. And transitional justice, as you said, is this idea of how do you reckon with the history or the past of human rights abuses. And there's a number of tools in this particular toolkit that are generally used. One can be criminal prosecutions for individuals who are related to and supported and instrumentalized the previous regime. There were very few criminal prosecutions in the Czech Republic. A second move is called lustration. Lustration is basically purging. So you identify individuals who are deemed to be associated with the heinous ancien regime, you know, in this case, the communist government, and you purge them from their jobs so they can't be physicians, lawyers, judges, public officials, professors, radio broadcasters, whatever you have. They're removed from those posts. Other forms of transitional justice include restitution and reparations. So, for example, the return of private property that had been nationalized by the state, reparations, payments of funds to individuals who had suffered harms under the state. Another mechanism is clarity, is the publishing of the secret police files or other records and evidence of the oppressive acts of the prior government. And then there's also things like architectural changes, refurbishing buildings, toppling sculptures, building new ones, and so forth. In the Czech Republic, the two major transitional justice instruments that were used that affected informers were A, lustration, and B, clarity. And in fact, those two were connected, because it was often the publication of lists or information of informers that led to their being purged in from public office or jobs, to them being socially marginalized and often humiliated. And just to get to the end, the main argument that we make in this part of the book is that the dual nature of lustration and clarity targeted informers who are so easily scapegoatable, because informers tend to be vilified everywhere and anywhere. Informers in the Czech Republic were scapegoated, and that provided a sense of cruelty to them, and we argue a sense of false comfort to everyone else, whose own complicity in the previous regime could be masked by the creepiness almost of being able to point to the informer as a menace to society.
And Barbora, it sounds then there's a process potentially taking place here, that if you are concerned that you might be identified as somebody who had worked with the state, you would probably better denounce somebody else to direct the attention onto somebody else. And so I guess, how much was this lustration process a shield for everyone else to, Mark mentioned scapegoating, and a motivation here would be, let's get talking about this guy because he's been the one doing the informing so that nobody looks at me.
Yeah, to an extent, this dynamics was there as well, of course. And not so much perhaps lustrations, but much more this publishing, the clarity laws, right? So the lists and the opening of the files. And in that sense, indeed, because communism, if you think about it, to an extent, everyone and anyone is complicit. So everyone and anyone can be held responsible to an extent to, for the regime. So in that sense, sort of pointing fingers at informers would have served exculpation of all the others. Look at them. And I think that it wasn't so much lustrations, but much more the publication of lists and clarity laws. And what happened in Czech Republic was actually that after the Velvet Revolution, the first lists that were published were unofficial. It wasn't the state who actually published the lists, but it was one private individuals who got hold of the lists and sort of released them to the public in the newspapers. And it was a huge thing, actually, back in the time. So there were, for example, queues before newspaper stands in order to get these newspapers and see whether your neighbors are, or whoever informed. So it was a big thing. And state actually started to discuss clarity laws and opening of the files as a reaction to these unofficial lists, because it caused such a societal uproar that they were also forced to start making official measures when it comes to informers.
Yeah, and Barbara, it seems to me that a huge motivation here is, at least in part, because under communism, again, there was so little transparency. You know, whatever news about what was going on in the country was whispered to one another, the state wasn't going to acknowledge this, that there would be a natural inclination once the government opens and then it actually falls to say, we've had to whisper about this. We literally don't know what's been going on. So that would be a huge motivation. But of course, individuals could be tied up into this. So I guess it's fair to say it was a natural inclination to say, you haven't let us talk about this. So the first thing when we open up is, let's talk about what's just happened. But what are the implications of that?
Yeah, no, well, so because of the secrecy and arbitrariness, I think that the new democratic government said, okay, let's endorse transparency and openness, which is also to an extent like a transitional justice mantra, I think, nowadays, that, yeah, everything should be transparent and open. And what we argue in the book is that this sort of utter transparency and utter openness can also be cruel to an extent. It can be cruel to individuals who actually then become exposed. They become exposed, and I'm not talking only about the informers themselves, but also about the informed upons, where basically their not so heroic deeds are also exposed to the public. So the fact that they might have been drinking too much as well, and the fact that they might have been affairs as well, and they were not only resisting the repressive government, but also living normal life and perhaps doing things which they might not be so proud of afterwards. And this sort of complete opening of everything for everyone and anyone to see, we argue, is an exercise of cruelty to an extent.
Yeah, and Mark, from an institutional perspective, it seems like there's two potential victims here that we really have to think about. The first is people who actually, you know, had done things that they're not proud of, but it gets exposed, and possibly even the descriptions make it seem much worse than what they actually did. But I also imagine that some of this publication and some of this process illustration tied up people who really weren't guilty at all. That one of the reasons why we have a faith in a trial system is some version of an innocent until proven guilty, that just because you're charged doesn't mean you're guilty. But it seems like this becomes, there had to be some individuals who were really pretty innocent that ended up getting tied up into that. So how did the Czech Republic manage those challenges?
Well, a couple of responses to that. First, there were processes that were set up by which individuals could challenge lustration that had been made against them, or otherwise obtain a sort of a positive certificate that they had not been informers in the years of communism. And it's very interesting because these processes almost revitalized the salience and factual accuracy of these particular files that otherwise had been discredited as just being abusive and authoritarian. So there was some process, but at the end of the day, as you well know, once you're accused, if you're ultimately exonerated, everyone remembers accused and exoneration and expungement tends to just fade into the mists of time. And that leads to the second point that I think is important to make. And that is that accusations of being an informer or being complicit with the prior regime were often motivated politically. Post-communist regimes have their own politics. And post-communist regimes tend to, get rid of opponents by accusing them as being supporters of the previous communist regime. In the case of informers, as Barbora has already set out, the vast majority of informers, they didn't care about politics. They weren't pro or anti-communist. They just wanted to get through the day. And of course, they used language of Marxist-Leninism when speaking to the STB officer, but that language filled all aspects of daily life, just like neoliberal market capitalist language fills the way we talk about things and all the, you know, idioms that we use now, even here in talking to you. So I think that's also important, that namely that information can be politically used in the post-communist years to get rid of opponents. And the third thing that I think is really important, and this riffs off of what Barbora had very thoughtfully presented as sort of the limits of clarity and transparency. These files are open. All children, nephews, nieces, grandchildren, friends, acquaintances, descendants can read these files and see what informers said. And they're searchable. They're all digitized. They're all available online. And you can actually get all this information about other people in your lives, in your parents' lives, going back in time. And that information can be embarrassing. Can I tell you something? What's really interesting to us, the STB officers in the day were compiling all this info, typing it up on tissue paper, and putting it in manila folders. The vast majority of information they received, they didn't do much with. All this gossip sat on the dusty files in, you know, locked away somewhere. The secret police officer often used discretion and kept things secret. Then transitional justice activists come in, get everything online because cultures of secrecy are apparently rancid, and everything goes public. I think it's important to ask whether that is always a net good. And Barbora and I are not convinced.
Are really like a tabloid newspapers of the time. It's incredible what one finds in there. And for example, of course, I am Czech, so I can speak the language. So I looked up whether there are files for all my family members. And there were some, actually. And what I found out, for example, is my mom always used to tell me that she had straight A's at high school. No, she did not. And these are the things that you can find actually in the files. There are really very, very, very private things which are now on public display.
Absolutely. You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about informants, about the process of opening up, you know, transparency, the process of clarity, revealing who the informants were, and the implications that has on a post-autocratic state like the Czech Republic, with Mark Rumble of Washington Lee University and Barbora Ola of the BU Amsterdam. They are the authors of a new book called Informers Up Close. So ultimately, you're critical of at least, you know, some aspects of these policies. I mean, at one level, clarity is incredibly important because you can't write the book without the clarity and getting the insights into why people are informers. But what are the lessons that we should take from this? Barbara, I'll ask you first. What ultimately, what lessons can we take from the experience of the Czech Republic? Because this is obviously an issue that gets replicated in so many different countries, not just the former communist regimes in Eastern Europe, but so many autocracies.
Yeah, it's a very big question. I think that for that we would need another podcast, Doug. But well, I think that every post-communist country did it slightly differently. So, for example, in Eastern Germany, the archives of Stasi are also opened, but they are opened in such way that the private information is being redacted. So you have many archivists actually sitting and meticulously redacting the files which are being asked for by individuals, and only redacted files are then given for public display. And I think that that might be the way how to go forward when it comes to the files, for example, to redact the private information so that I would not know that it was my mother who did not have straight A's at high school. You know what I mean? So in that sense, that can be one lesson learned, because oftentimes, in the sake of transparency, any other concerns and collateral damages are sort of swiped out of the table. And I think it is not the right way how to do things.
Mark, I'll ask you the same question about some key lessons I think you might take from this.
Yeah, so I think I'd give four key lessons. First, transitional justice is supposedly about law, equality, equity, and justice. But in reality, it's often about politics, power, and control. And our first sort of takeaway, I think, is we just need to own that and recognize that. But then secondly, if transitional justice is about power and control, then it becomes all the more important to safeguard the dignity of individuals who fall within its gaze. And in our book, we propose a way in which a heuristic, a format in which transitional justice ought to talk about informers, and that throughout is imbued with the centrality of dignity, and recognizing, which leads me to the third point, that transitional justice now can be quite retributive. Best practices in transitional justice, including lustration and clarity, can be quite retributive. And we basically call for a return to the roots of transitional justice, which is the centrality of reconciliation. And we believe that our tweaks to transitional justice rooted in dignity through a case study of the informer in one country can actually help revitalize the centrality of reconciliation to processes of post-authoritarian reconstruction instead of the current frame where, you know, the old boss is out, the new bosses are in, and the new bosses and the old bosses may sound different, but they sure act alike. And our fourth big takeaway, I think, is informers are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. You know, we talk a lot in international criminal law scholarship of the ordinary man or the ordinary woman. And this is generally placed in the context of how an ordinary person joins the Nazi Einsatzgruppen, the mobile killing squads, right? Or stands on the path in Rwanda and kills 100 people with a machete. But informing is truly the most ordinaire of the ordinary, right? The most quotidian of the common. And everyone has been an informer at one point in their lives. Everyone has ratted someone out for something at some point. And I think what's really important in this space is to recognize the ubiquity of informers, that informers are necessary for any state, no matter how vile or virtuous. And therefore, when we come to talk about what happens to informers who ended up on the wrong side of history and who committed a lot of harm in that space, we think it's simply important to do so in a way that avoids the ease of scapegoating. Because however common informers are, they're also commonly reviled. And we would like to suggest that that's too easy. And perhaps we ought to be a little bit more demanding of ourselves.
Before I'm going to ask you the last question then, since at this point we're actually fairly broad, but I would like to return back to the Czech Republic and just ask, ultimately, this process, has it been generally beneficial for democracy in the Czech Republic? How optimistic are you about the Czech Republic's, you know, sort of future of democracy and transparency, et cetera, especially because a number of countries in that region, I think of Poland and Hungary, have not had a great experience. But should we be pretty optimistic about what's going on in the Czech Republic?
I think everything is relative. And in that sense, in comparison to Hungary and Poland, I think the Czech Republic is doing pretty well. And I would be optimistic when it comes to democracy and yeah, openness, transparency. I think that the path that has been taken after the revolution is still pretty strong. So I wouldn't be afraid there. And I was teaching a little bit, and I think that young students in Czech Republic at Charles University and young students are very much comparable to students in the West, I think. So nowadays when it comes to their thinking and thoughts. So in that sense, I wouldn't be scared. And I am usually quite pessimist. So in that sense, I would be pretty optimistic when it comes to future.
No, absolutely. So obviously, we've been discussing this question about, you know, who are the informants? Why would somebody inform? One of the great things about the Clarity Law and the way that you've explored in the book is just to get a better understanding of what those motivations are, to kind of crack some of the stereotypes we might have about informants. And so one of the big takeaways is, why do informers inform? The answer is, it's complicated. And each of the cases show some degree of complication, but also I think some important insights, as Mark, you know, highlighted, about what are some of the best practices for transitional justice. For people who do this research, there have been kind of these standard arguments for the last 20, 25 years, maybe even a little bit longer than that. We need to revisit that and actually, you know, take a look and see what each of the cases suggest. And I think this case in Czechoslovakia and the Czech Republic, it's provided a lot of really interesting insight to anybody who's interested in transitional justice, as well as how do repressive regimes operate and get informants to inform. So the title of the book is called Informers Up Close. The authors, Mark Drumble, he is professor at Washington Lee University School of Law, the director of the university's Transnational Law Institute, the author of Atrocity Punishment in International Law, Reimagining Child Soldiers in International Law and Policy. He's also the co-editor of Sights, Sounds, and Sensibilities of Atrocity Prosecution with Caroline Fournet. And Barbora Hola works as the senior researcher at the NSCR and is professor in the Department of Criminal Law and Criminology at VU Amsterdam. She's the co-editor of Punishment in International Society, Norms, Justice, and Punitive Practices, and the co-author of There's Something Special About War Criminals. First, thank you very much for writing the book and sharing it with me so I had a chance to read it. And most importantly, for sharing your time and your expertise today in talking about such an important topic. Thank you very much.
We close with an excerpt from a talk given by British historian Timothy Garton Ash, author of The File, about how countries emerging from authoritarianism must confront their past, lest they be haunted by it. The File is a memoir in which Garton Ash looks at his file compiled by the Stasi and confronts those who informed against him. It is a 1997 talk that was organized by C-SPAN.
And actually, I think there's a strong argument that the residual suspicion, the uncertainty, the distrust that was there already at the time of the East German regime because of the Stasi would be perpetuated by not opening the files. Opening the files, in a way, is the best path to closing them. And there's another argument, which is, look what happened elsewhere in post-communist Europe, where they tried to do what the Spaniards did after Franco, which was to say, let bygones be bygones, forgive and forget, draw a thick line under the past, no trials, no purges, no history lesson, amnesty and amnesia. Well, you could argue that to some extent it actually worked in Spain. Spanish democracy has been built on a foundation of kind of amnesia. But it certainly didn't work in the post-communist world. Look at Poland, where it was tried quite decisively by the first communist government, I mean, Solidarity government. What happened there was that the subject of the communist past, and specifically of the secret police, kept coming back to haunt Polish politics because it hadn't been dealt with, because it hadn't been confronted. First of all, there was a famous occasion when a right-wing interior minister suddenly produced about 60 files, evidence from secret police files, one dramatic night in the Polish parliament. It was called in Polish the Nocteczek, which might loosely be translated as the night of the long files. And these files, as it happened, were mostly on the political opponents of that government, including the then president, Lech Wałęsa. There was no way of scrupulously checking these files at the time. Then again, in 1995, the outgoing interior minister accused his own post-communist prime minister of having been a KGB agent, and the prime minister finally had to resign as a result. Even in the last election campaign, there was an accusation made that the President Kwasniewski, had himself had contacts with the KGB. So the past keeps coming back to haunt you because you haven't confronted it, just as it did come back to haunt post-war West Germany. The Nazi past, as we all know, came back to haunt post-war West Germany. in the 60s and 70s, precisely because it had been repressed and suppressed in the 1950s. Similarly with France, as we've seen the so-called Vichy syndrome, the way in which the history of Vichy again and again has dogged French politics. François Mitterrand, even at the end of his career, now in the Papon trial. That's what happens if you don't confront the past swiftly and get it behind you. So the point of doing this is not to dwell on the past, but to find out what happened, record, reflect, and then to move on. And I find it very interesting that Poland and the Czech Republic and Hungary, which initially were quite skeptical about the Gauck model of opening the secret police files, are now at various stages of adopting a modified version of it. In the Czech Republic, Czech citizens now have the right to see their own files. In Hungary, the same is true, although not many people are applying. And there is an active discussion in Poland of doing the same thing. By the way, what an extraordinary development it is when just 50 years after the end of the Second World War, when the Poles come to think about how they might deal with their own difficult past, they look to Germany as a model. Interesting to think what has changed in Europe in those 50 years. So those are the few comments and thoughts I wanted to lay before you.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.